The Five Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified and another beautiful rainy morning in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to welcome you to our show. Today in studio with me is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Carl. And Kevin Stege is busy doing taxes, which is good because he's my CPA, and I'm glad that he is busy working. We need all the help we can get when it comes to the IRS. And speaking about not the IRS, but today we got an exciting show. We got Rodney Johnson, co-editor of the free newsletter with Harry S. Dent, The Economist, Survive and Prosper. And if you haven't got your copy, you need to go to my website at pfgwm.com. We have a link there. You can sign up for that. And also, you can go to harrydent.com and sign up for it there, too. And so we should have Rodney on the line with us here shortly. And Rodney's here to answer your questions, my questions, and we do have him on the line. So we'll be connecting with Rodney here shortly. I got to tell you, if you haven't went to the Dent site, you need to do it. You need to also go to my website, but go to the Harry Dent site and check out Harry Dent's information. I just got my copy. I get Survive and Prosper all the time. And what? Okay, Rodney, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great, Rodney. I was just had done my introduction to you, and I was giving a little more plug to send people to your guys' website to check out. And I tell you, I was real excited yesterday. Of course, you know, yesterday was Valentine's Day, so I had to take care of business with my wife and make sure that she had a good day. But when I got home last night and I pulled up my email, I had the Dent research letter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a special feature there by Rodney Johnson about 5 million people are missing.
Missing from the workforce, absolutely, in terms of participating in the labor force, either employed or looking for work actively.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big misnomers of when we hear unemployment rates in America.
Mm-hmm.
They're totally... Are they just like a guess in the dark?
Well, and you know, Chuck, it's something that we've looked at for a long time, which you know, being so involved in the research, is the federal government and the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out the numbers for unemployment. And I don't think that they're trying to lie to anybody, but certainly the government and anyone would try to put the best face possible on where we are at any given time, be it now in a difficult economy or during a good economy. And so the unfortunate part is in the last several years, we've fundamentally had some changes go on. And one of them is that people are not starting new businesses at nearly the rate that they used to. And so that's very important when looking at unemployment, because some of what the Bureau of Labor Statistics does is they do a survey of businesses to see how many jobs are created, but they only look at businesses that are 5 years old or older and have more than 1,000 employees. That leaves out small employers, and it leaves out all new businesses. And so what they do is they guess, and they have a measure for this. It's called the birth-death adjustment, the birth being new businesses formed and the death being businesses that go bankrupt. And so the government literally guesses at how many new businesses were created and how many people they employ. And so that's been a fudge number for a long time that we've called out, because in this difficult economy, people are literally not starting those businesses. But it bleeds over into something that you brought up, which was the article yesterday that I'd written in the research about how 5 million people are missing. There are actually almost 14 million people who have been added to the age of being able to work over 16. We know some of them have retired. We know that number is around 5.5 million. We know that several million of them are working, and we know that, you know, what has happened along the group. But it left this 5 million person number of who are they? And it appears from our research that they are people who are younger than 65. They're not in retirement age, who have literally checked out of the workforce. They're not employed, and they're not looking for a job. And that's the real problem, is we have this group of people who are young enough to work. They're just not out there.
Well, we do have a our lines here. If somebody wants to call in and ask Rodney a question, you can call 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And we have an 800 number, 1-800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. And I'm also giving away this week in our, if people call in, I'm giving them a copy of the Democratic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014-19, Harry's new book.
Well, say, Rodney, you know, you were talking about the missing 5 million people. One of the things that we see in our firm, because I do, you mentioned not starting new businesses and things, we typically do a fair amount of small corporation formation and that sort of thing. And we have not had, you know, anywhere near the numbers of those things in the past 5 years. It's, I used to be doing at least one or two or three a month, and now I'll bet I haven't done, you know, two or three in the last year of a new business startup. So that's very consistent with what you're saying. And then also we see in the estate planning side of it, we see a lot of families who have one or more family members who are no longer working, and they're kind of moved in with mom and dad just because they have to. So I guess I don't know how that's a very small sampling, but it's certainly consistent with what you were saying.
Well, and it's out there, and we all know people that have fallen into this group, and it could be something as seemingly innocuous as a couple with a few kids, one of them loses their job, aren't able to find a job quickly, certainly not at their old income level, and if they do go back to work, they have to pay for daycare. And so they make arrangements to where one spouse can stay home. Well, that spouse is now caring for a family member or caring for a family, and so they no longer count as active in the labor force because they have now voluntarily chosen not to. The question becomes, what happens if a job does open up? Does that spouse now go back to work? Well, now they've made an arrangement not to do it. And so that's the sort of thing where you got to look at this long term and say, hey, wait a second, it could be that as things do ease up, which they will in a few years, that these people may not choose to go back to work. Now, while that's good for the individual family, it takes a worker out of employment, it takes income out of the deal, they don't spend as much, and so it kind of slows down growth overall. You mentioned people living at home or coming back and doing what's called multifamily living, where you might have, you know, roommates, or you might go live with parents or have adult kids come back home. That slows down family formation and household formation so that we don't sell as many homes. And so these have long-term effects on the economy that we have to understand to see how we're kind of holding back growth for years to come. It's not just today. It actually has a knock-on effect for years to come.
You know, one of the things I constantly am amazed about when you guys have an economic summit, we go into demographics, which, of course, is the big thing the Dent Group is about. And it's pretty amazing to me when you look at and you guys talk to us about what's happening in Japan and how their situation is now, where they've continued on this path that we're heading down. And it doesn't look real good.
No, it doesn't. And the Japanese, you know, they got old in terms of their population aging 20 years ago. And right now, 1 in 4 people in Japan are over 65. And that's a number that Americans can say out loud, but it's hard to get your arms around it. It's like we all lived in Florida, you know. And so it's a functional thing that's just, imagine that every fourth person in the grocery store is slow at getting their money out of their purse or their wallet because they didn't remember they had to pay, or took an extra 45 seconds to pull out into traffic because, frankly, they can't see that well. I mean, it would dramatically change your daily living. That's what life is in Japan. And so those people don't spend as much money. They're not making money anymore. They're living on fixed income. Doesn't mean they live badly. It just means they're not growing their situation. And so it has an incredible dampening effect on the economy. We're going that direction. We'll never get to the point of Japan. We have many more younger people than the Japanese do, and we have kids. But it doesn't mean we're not going to have some sort of a lid or slowdown happen, because we do have this aging baby boom set that right now is more focused on paying down debt and saving for retirement, and will be a group of very large retirees. They're going to, frankly, be living out there not working for 25 years, and they're going to be the people in front of you at the grocery store that you wish they'd just hurry up.
Or move to Florida.
Yeah, well, I live in Florida, so let's not say everybody moves here. Yeah. So let's make sure we're clear about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, you know, one of the things I tell my legal assistant every now and then, people ask me when I'm going to retire, and I just tell them that when they come into my office and I'm not moving and I smell funny, I'm retired. So that's a
you know, that's an interesting point you make, because you are self-employed.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I am.
And so you determine the growth or contraction of your business. You work harder, you do more marketing and different things, you help people, and you put together good advice and information for them, and you grow your business, or you choose, I'm not going to do as much, I'm not going to look out for new clients, I'm gonna, you know, do what I can to kind of partner up in whatever I am. Most people who work don't have those choices. And so it's very interesting, as you look through the economy, there are a lot of baby boomers who are self-employed, but it's not anywhere near the majority. It's not even 25-30%. It's a small group. Most people have a job where, you know, they don't punch a clock, but they do have structure and management, and it's a big company. And so what's going to happen is they're going to hit retirement age, 62 or 65, and they're out the door. Doesn't mean some people won't continue to work, but it means the overwhelming number of people are going to follow the very traditional path of working till retirement age and then checking out.
You know, that's interesting, because about 25 years ago, I had been working for Fortune 500 companies doing various other things, and I began to realize that, you know, the lifelong job with a particular company no longer existed. And so I went back to becoming self-employed again, and I'm very, very glad that I did, because of that very reason, because at this point, I am self-employed, and I have a practice that is potentially movable if I had to, but I don't think it will. But I mean, and our firm has grown, and we're trying to grow more, and we do that by, you know, trying to provide the best service we can and those sorts of things. But it has its problems too. You know, expanding a business is always challenging, and you know, there's only so many hours in the day that you can do work, but most of us really feel like we want to keep doing it. We've got a number of people who are approaching retirement age, myself included, but it's not retirement age for us. We're really looking at as long as we're healthy and capable, we intend to keep working at it. So and like you said, not everybody has that choice, and we're real grateful to have it. So
I'm right there with you. You know, in my work, I'm very lucky in what I do, and that I can work for a long time. And it is, you know, whatever we put into it that we're going to get out of it. But as we look around and say, well, you know, what's the population going to do? There are some things where you say, wait a second, we can't have everybody doing that. If everybody was able to work a very long time past in the traditional retirement age and wanted to, then younger people would never get an opportunity to grow into those jobs. And so there is some turnover in the economy that is exceptionally useful for creating those opportunities for the next set. Somebody retires, a 50-year-old takes their place, a 40-year-old takes that place, a 30-year-old takes that place, and then a new employee takes the 30-year-old's place. So you want people moving up that ladder and creating these openings. And it's very interesting, because as we look at it, not necessarily for people who are self-employed, but people who could have retired earlier, say maybe 62, they're now looking at it and saying, I didn't grow my assets, or perhaps I took a big hit in the downturn. I have to stay to 65 or 66 as the retirement age moves up. And they're keeping a lid on employment, because by not stepping off the ladder, that next place is not created. And that's another way that the younger set is really taking a back seat in this economy right now.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I did notice through here, and just took a quick look through here, that there was a discussion about mandatory retirement. Of course, we've had numerous legal questions about if a company can actually force you to retire and force you out the door. So
it's a really good question. There's you know, I'm not an employment lawyer by any stretch, but I do remember that retirement was mandatory at 65 when I was coming along in the 70s and 80s, and I remember distinctly, I'm going to have to go look this up to verify, that Walter Cronkite retired, and he turned 65, and it was a big deal when he retired at the normal age. Retirement, mandatory retirement at 65 was removed in the mid-80s because our labor force had changed structure. But you have to go all the way back to when Social Security was enacted and understand it was partially a make-work program to create openings for younger people by requiring people to retire at 65. And so this idea has been around before. Chances are it'll come back again. How legal is it? Well, that depends on the law of the land at the time.
Well, we have an attorney here.
I don't profess to be a labor lawyer or an employment lawyer either, but I do know that companies, they do have ways of getting people to retire that, you know, that are legal, some maybe not. I think sometimes what they look at is how to, you know, thin down the workforce in some fashion. They just have to be wary that they're, you know, they can't just say, well, we're just going to cut all of the old guys.
Right.
That doesn't work. But they can do things like, well, we can cut out this many managers. And you know, if it turns out that all of the managers seem to be old guys, well, oops. But I mean, they have to be cautious about those kinds of things. But still, it can happen. But it usually comes in the sense of thinning the workforce, really, more than anything else, I think.
And we may be approaching that time again where that's going to have to happen.
We sure could. And, you know, it's one of those things. You got to pick which outcome is least bad. Right now, we have an excess supply of labor, if you want to look at it that way. And when you have that, then the employer has kind of the upper hand, and so they don't have to pay a higher wage to get more people to apply. I mean, McDonald's has a lower acceptance rate than Harvard when you look at the number of people that apply for jobs and the number of people that actually get jobs. And so we're at a point right now where that's just the way it is. And so the way to alleviate that, you know, there are only a couple of ways. One, you have fewer people who are applying for jobs or in jobs, and this is one of the ways of doing it, or you create more jobs. And both of those have, you know, some drawbacks, because creating jobs, well, now you're really looking at the government, and now you're funding it through taxes, borrowing, and Lord knows the situation just gets worse from there.
Well, you know, one of the things that we look at, and I talk to people about that, you know, things might be very, very difficult, but in reality, we have a way as a country. We normally will make the changes, whether it be politically or socially. We have been able to make those changes in the past and turn our economy around, even out of a very, very bad depression that ended up being a 20-plus year recession. You know, we've had the ability to rebound and come out of that. But, you know, if there are three things the government could do today to help turn this around, what would you guys think that would be?
Well, the very first thing, and I'll speak for myself, Harry's traveling in Australia, so I can't, you know, pop him on email here and ask him. But whereas the way I see it, the first thing that we could do as a government is provide clarity to individuals and businesses as to what the playing field looks like. And that's a problem right now, particularly by the Federal Reserve, and I know they're not technically part of the government, but let's, you know, understand they're under the umbrella. If you don't know the rules of the game or what the rules of the game are going to be in 3 months, 8 months, 2 years, then how in the world can you be more aggressive in playing the game? Because you're clearly playing defense all the time. If we don't know what interest rates are going to do, if we don't know what monetary policy is going to be because the Fed can change at any time, if we don't know what regulations are going to be through the EPA or through the Bureau of Labor, Department of Labor, you know, we're end up playing defense. If we don't know what the healthcare rules are going to be, then how can we clearly set out what we're going to do in businesses? And if we don't know what taxes are going to be? And so clarity and consistency on the rules is the first thing and always the biggest thing. If we change some tax rates for businesses, yeah, that could do it some. I'm not so much of a fan of that. If we instead decided to close some loopholes and clearly make it to where we're all playing the same game, that goes back to consistency and clarity, that would be good, but clearly attack the tax structure in the United States to make it simpler. That would be great. And finally, I am of a mind that we could put more money into renovating the nation, you know, in terms of the highways, in terms of the bridges, and some infrastructure that is clearly crumbling, but we haven't streamlined it. We haven't done what we could have done with the pipeline. If the President of the United States declares that it's in the national interest to rebuild bridges, then we bypass a lot of the regulations or impact studies by the EPA and other things. And if we said that, which I clearly think it is, then we could quickly start putting, shovel-ready projects to work, which we haven't done yet. And so I think those three things would be the best thing for the nation today and would put us on a pretty solid footing for the next couple of years while we wait for the natural demographics to come back and the younger set to get to a point where they are growing their family and spending more money.
Rodney, what would you think would happen if they took a substantial portion of the monthly QE payments and took that money away from the banks who are getting the money and instead just directly channeled it into these kind of renovation projects?
Well, I think it would I think it would be a tremendous boon, because if you look at the numbers and, you know, just kind of playfully or in jest, I wrote this about 6 months ago, I guess, where, you know, if you want to employ people, you start putting the numbers to it. The Federal Reserve is printing now, $65 billion a month. $65 billion with a B. I mean, what a number is that? And so if you look at it and say, well, I want to put 100,000 people to work. Okay, well, I've got 100,000. And those 100,000 people are going to make, call it $50,000 a year. Well, you know, that's $50 billion. I could actually employ more than 100,000 for a year with just the money that we're printing a month. And so you could start to see where the money could make a huge impact on people's lives. And it's very focused, because if you're doing renovation of infrastructure, then you're clearly doing things that have to do with construction. It's big construction. It's not single-family homes, but it's concrete. It is asphalt. It is rebar. It is steel. And so you would be looking at the exact jobs that the Fed has been trying to target for so many years by trying to move the ball in housing, which isn't going to work. And you would instead be going right to the source of saying, use this money to build these things. Now, the Fed can't do that directly, but certainly there is a path where the federal government could pass a law and they borrow more, the Fed buys the bonds. It's doable. I can do it in less than 30 seconds, so certainly people who do this for a living at the Federal Reserve and the federal government could do it even quicker. And so I think it would have a dramatic effect on employment and really on the mindset of the nation, and it would give us this infrastructure that's going to last the next 100 years. So it's a win all the way around.
Well, the only thing I would add to that is I think that would be a terrific idea, and I think that was a great idea. And I think the one mistake Franklin Delano Roosevelt did when he funded that highway project to get people back to work in the TVA, I would do it without the government oversight. I would do it, give the money to the states and have them hire private companies and put people to work on private payrolls, not on government payrolls, because government just doesn't handle payrolls real well.
Well, and I completely agree with you, Chuck. And I in the 30s, the infrastructure didn't exist because we were not yet a fully urban society. And so if you wanted to put a million people to work, it wasn't going to be possible without the government, I don't think. I wasn't a fan of the whole brown shirts thing and the Conservation Corps, but, you know, it did its job. I wouldn't like to see it come back again, certainly. But there are so many private companies out there that can do this in their locale that I think your point is well taken. It's the federal government that made these funds available to states. It specifically had to be in addition to what they're already doing, instead of allowing them to just replace their own money with federal money and then go do something else. I think it's very doable, and if you did it in national interest, you could bypass Davis-Bacon compliance on wages and all sorts of crazy things that slow down the process and make it more expensive.
Well, you know, there are so many people that are that were in middle management, and I have a client who's now actually working in Africa because she had a job at a very high level with a firm downtown, and was making about $90,000 a year. When that firm took cutbacks, then every time she applied for a job, because she was in her early 50s, her age was against her, but also her level of education and her income. She had a job for $36,000 a year, and the company told her that out of the 350 people that applied, she was number one. But the guy said, listen, if I hire you, my boss will fire me because you're overqualified. You're overqualified for the job, and as soon as this economy turns, you're going to be gone.
Exactly.
It's just a vicious cycle for people who really want to work. We've got to do something in this country to have available people to get jobs who really want to work.
Right, and your point is well taken, and we all know it. You hire somebody who's exceptionally qualified, who's been out of work for 4 or 5 months, and you know what they're doing. They're looking for any job possible. And you also know that who in their right mind would not, after taking a job that is well below their qualifications, keep looking around, and when something at their qualification level and much higher in income came along, immediately leave. I mean, we have to do the best for our own personal economy, and so we all know why it happens. The question is, what do you do about it other than trying to create new jobs?
Yeah, that is the big dilemma we have in this country right now is jobs.
Yep.
And what amazes me is our from a political standpoint, both political parties, they ought to be standing out there screaming this every single day instead of doing all this other crap they're doing or not doing.
Well, unfortunately, you know, you're veering into an area that frustrates the snot out of me. Because in my world, most of what I see politicians do is angle for the next election. It has very little to do with moving the country forward. And so when I see things like, you know, this debt ceiling that they passed a debt ceiling level that allows the country to continue borrowing until March of 2015. March of 2015, there's nothing magic about it. If you wanted to match it up and do something smart, then you would have the debt ceiling, which I agree, you have to borrow money to pay for things you've already agreed to purchase. I understand that. Have the debt ceiling go until September 30th, because that's the end of the fiscal year. And then set a budget and set your debt level borrowing for 1 year at a time. So you're agreeing on what to spend and what to borrow at the same moment. But Lord knows we can't do that because the midterm elections are a month later. So nobody's going to do anything that might, you know, rock the boat in front of election because it's all about getting elected.
Well, you know, there's one real simple solution to solve that problem that we need to have in America, and that's called term limitations. We have them for the president. I don't understand why in this country we can't do the same thing with our congresspeople, our representatives and senators. I mean, my gosh, some of those people have been in there 20-some years. They've become multimillionaires. The country's went into horrendous debt, and they keep getting elected.
I completely agree. I've yet to understand it other than term limits have to be voted on by the very people who would be hurt by it. So, of course, it's not going to occur. And Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, whom I did not know, I have no connection to West Virginia politics. He could have been the best guy on the planet. But when he recently passed and he was, you know, put in state for viewing and it was a big deal, one of the points that was commonly made at the time was he had been in Congress since 1957. And I just don't understand how someone can be in Congress for half a century and anyone thinks it's okay, because how could you possibly understand what the rest of us are doing when you've lived in this bubble for half a century? It still boggles my mind. We had a senator down here, a congressman down here, Bob Young, who recently passed, and he had been in Congress for, I think, right at 40 years. And it leaves me scratching my head. How is this possible? Why does it make sense? And unfortunately, we know because voters don't in general go to the voting booth and vote for somebody new. Incumbents win 96% of the time because people have name recognition.
Yeah, how lame is that, though? I mean, you would hope that as this country's gotten more and more mature and our educational standards supposedly are heading in the upward motion, although I think they're going downward, you would think that people would have enough common sense to realize, hey, look, these guys have been around for 40 years, and for over 50 years is why we've had this big debt problem. Maybe we need to make a change and get these guys out of there.
I couldn't agree more. I would immediately actually start, you know, unwinding a lot of the benefits. I don't understand why you can work, you know, two terms and then get a pension for life. I don't understand a lot of the perks that are conferred upon members of Congress that don't apply to the rest of the United States. It's like, well, you're representing me, but you're getting the better end of this deal. I really don't get that at all. And so I think there are many, many things we could do to make it to where our representatives were much more interested in representing us. I don't mean that politicians are bad, and it's a tough job. I understand it. But right now, I think it's just skewed the wrong direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I again encourage people to go to our website or to go to your website and sign up for Survive and Prosper. They can go to harrydent.com. And I also have a link to that on my website at pfgwm.com to sign up for that newsletter. And it is a great newsletter. We get it, and I know, Carl, you're getting it. And Rodney, I really enjoy your comments, and I enjoy your wit in your discussions because I think you do a great job of Harry's just totally boom. He's out there, and he just bam, bam, bam. He's like a machine gun. And you've got some articulate wit that is really great, and we really appreciate it. We appreciate you coming on the show. By the way, how's the weather in Tampa?
You know, it's cold today. It's about 67 degrees and a little bit of a breeze. And, I mean, I'm bundled up a little bit. I don't know what I'm going to do about this.
Oh, God, we're going to cry for you because ours is probably about 53 and raining.
Oh, no, ours is sunny. So, I mean, this is winter is our convertible weather. We have 6 months where we just put the top down and hang out.
Well,
and the low is around 55 and the high is 73, 74. And, yeah, that happens for months at a time.
Well, that's going to make all of our Northwesterners think about packing up, closing up shop, and moving to Florida.
Just remind them the summer is humid and rainy and terrible. You don't want to do this.
Yeah, see, there you go. Hey, listen, we appreciate your time, and we'll talk to you in a couple of months.
Sounds great. Thank you
both.
Thanks,
Rodney.
Thanks, Rodney.
Bye-bye. Listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We're going to take a quick break, come right back. And if you want to call and ask a question of Carl or Chuck Price, you can call 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. You people who are listening to us on the web or in the outlying areas, it's 1-800-990-0750. That's 1-800-990-0750. Investing Simplified.
Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Huh. Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and we are wrapping up our show today after a nice discussion with Rodney Johnson. It's always interesting to hear his perspective, and he's a lot of fun. Today we're going to have a little bit of Carl's comments, and that's where I talk about some of the things that come up in my practice and hopefully things that will be of interest to you. One of the things that I think many of us will face in our futures is maybe becoming a trustee, because there are a lot of wills and a lot of trusts out there, and then somebody dies, and the next thing you know, you're called upon to act as a trustee. And this is a very important job, and one of those things, quite frankly, that in today's world is a little bit dangerous.
I've seen a lot more litigation about trusts, and usually it has to do with the money, as you might expect. You know, they always show me the money. Well, surprise, surprise, if the money sort of disappears or goes in the wrong places, a lot of people get really upset about it. And so today I wanted to talk about, if you're appointed a trustee, 12 things to do to avoid litigation and trouble all in all. So first of all, if you become a trustee, read the trust. Get a sense of what it really says, and then you probably should get some professional advice from a lawyer to interpret the thing for you. Because a lot of times the language in a trust is more of a map than more of a compass rather than a map. And it's useful to get a sense of it, but you have to have some interpretation sometimes as to what it means. But get a sense of what the trust is supposed to do. Who's it for? Who are the beneficiaries? That sort of thing. And what are you supposed to do as its trustee? That's very important because everything is referred back to the trust and the trust language. Bear in mind that as a trustee, you have a fiduciary obligation to the beneficiaries. Even if you're one of those beneficiaries. So you have to treat all of the beneficiaries fairly. And it's not your money. That's the other thing. You have to remember this is somebody else's money that you're administering for the benefit, and you have a legal obligation to administer the money for the benefit of somebody else, the beneficiary. So that's number one. Number two, review the trustor's papers and mail. Find out about their assets and creditors. Get the mail, find out what the statements are, start organizing some files if they've got an investment file or a brokerage file or a banking file. You want to have all of those things organized, and you need to get those papers so that you know what the assets are that you're dealing with. And also, those things will usually tell you, the mail will usually tell you if there are any outstanding creditors. Do you get a mortgage bill? Do you get some other thing that might be a long-standing credit thing, and then you're going to get the usual bills that you would pay, the utilities and those kinds of things. But it's very important to get a handle on those things and get yourself organized. You should start to get, number three, you should get an inventory started and get it done. Basically, what you need to do is identify the assets that exist, real estate, brokerage accounts, IRAs, 401ks, anything, jewelry collections or stamp collections or anything like that. Make a good list of them, and also try to get some kind of a fair market value. Fair market value of the stocks and stuff, of course, would be basically date of death value. Things like collections, you have to get appraised. Real estate, you can get some indication from whatever the assessor says it's supposed to be, but that's not usually acceptable for valuation purposes. So it might be worth, depending on what you're working with, it might be worth it to spend the $500 if it's a residential real estate to get an appraisal. If it's a commercial property, you probably want to look at getting an appraisal. And that's going to be more expensive because they're more difficult to appraise. But anyway, you should have some idea of what the fair market value is. And then prepare this inventory and then keep it up to date as things change, because you may be called upon to either manage or sell some of those assets. And that depends on whether you're going to be a trustee for a long time or whether you're going to have to distribute those assets right away. Those things will make a big difference to you. Number four, you should list the notify all the creditors. That's fairly that you're the trustee. Tell them that you're the trustee and you're going to be managing the trust. Number five, you should review existing insurance policies and make sure that you get insurance for assets like homes or rentals or whatever it might be. Just make sure that things that should be insured are insured, and that's part of your job. Change the ownership of the assets in the trust so that you are known as the trustee. In other words, if there's a brokerage or a bank account that's in the name of the trust, you need to go to that institution and make sure that you're signed on as the new trustee. Make sure that they have a copy of the trust that shows that you're the successor trustee, and so that you need to have the ability, not only in fact, but in law and in practice, to be able to manage those assets. And then you're called upon to invest trust assets in a prudent manner. And in this case, by all means, engage professional help. It's hard enough to be a trustee without trying to be an investment advisor as well. And you want to get somebody who knows what they're doing. And you might want to review again with your legal professional what it means to be a prudent investor. There are some specific rules about that. But basically, it means a reasonable and prudent person, and that probably means doing some kind of diversity and all that kind of things. It also means finding out what the needs of your beneficiaries are and what their, what their risk tolerance is. You know, if you've got a 90-year-old beneficiary, the last thing on earth you want to do is to get into an investment strategy that is really risky. You know, you're looking at a preservation strategy rather than a growth strategy. And in fact, in many cases, when you're really trying to make guarantee income or guarantee protection for a beneficiary, you're looking at a more conservative portfolio generally than because you're risking their money, not yours, and their life, not yours. So those are important things. Number nine, and this is really a big one, keep records and document the trustee decisions. Number one, keep the records of the financial records, but also when you're keep a journal of the events that you do. If you decide to invest this, that, or the other thing, or you decide to sell something, make a memo of it. Or if you decide to make a distribution to there's a discretionary distribution that you have to make to a beneficiary, write a note and put it in a file that says, I made this distribution and this is why. And that will be a very big help to you later on. It could be a journal or a note file or however you want to do it. Number 10, never, ever commingle your stuff with the trust stuff. It's not your money. You can't commingle it. You can't borrow money back and forth and use the trust checkbook and then say you're going to reimburse it. Don't do it. Keep the money absolutely separate. Keep the assets absolutely separate. And then you have to file tax returns. Number 11, you have to file any required tax returns. Generally speaking, most trusts will require that you file a fiduciary tax return on an annual basis. And again, get professional help. Don't try to TurboTax this one. This one's going to be a little more challenging for you, and I wouldn't recommend doing that. So, and then number 12, inform the beneficiaries. And this is really important. Be transparent. Nothing causes people to be upset with the trustee more than when they hide the ball and they say, I don't have to tell you anything. I'm the boss of you. You do that and you're going to be in court. I guarantee it. If you start pushing the beneficiary around and not telling them what they want to know, even if it's a pain in the neck, tell them what they want to know. Keep your records organized and provide them with information. Under law, you have to provide notice to them. When you become the trustee, you got to tell them that you're the trustee and you've accepted being the trustee. You need to tell them what the assets are. Give them a copy of the inventory. And then on an annual basis, you need to kind of basically do that same thing. Tell them what the trust is, what the trust does, and what it has done, and also what your expenses and disbursements were. Those are very important things to do. Again, when you don't do that, people get mad. And the next thing they know, when they get mad, the only person in the chair is you. So you're the trustee. It's a big job. That's another thing. You are entitled to compensation, but if you think you're going to accept compensation, some people say no, they're not. But if you are going to accept compensation, make sure that you get some advice on how much that ought to be and how you're going to calculate it, and then stick with it. Make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to do, and let the beneficiaries know that that's what you're going to do. So those are my advice for those of you who are becoming trustees. It can be a very big job, and depending on the nature of the beneficiaries, it can be very contentious because the beneficiaries almost always think that it should have been their money to do with as they please and not necessarily, controlled by somebody else. So, but usually the reason it's controlled by somebody else is because the trustor in this case probably felt like the person who they wanted to benefit wasn't quite, financially secure or financially capable at the time, and they wanted to at least delay some of the distributions or control some of the manner in how it's distributed. So not always a fun job, but a very, very, very rewarding one if you can do it well, but it is one that requires some effort. So good luck with that.
Yeah, well, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. If you got a question for Carl, you can call 503-417-7626, 503-417-7626, or toll-free 800-990-0750. That's 990-0750. We'll be right back with more Investing Simplified and the Knowledge Trust.
Yeah. rights and responsibilities are involved. You need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy you
and we're back.
A house.
Anyway, listen, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We don't have Kevin here today because Kevin's busy doing taxes, but Carl and I are here to answer your questions. And I'm going to give Cook just a quick stock report here, but I do want to mention one of the things, and from time to time I get emails from people who ask me about various investments because there are other radio shows around that are pushing annuities, and they're pushing bank on yourself by putting all your money into life insurance policies and borrowing the money out and getting it tax-free using the loopholes of the law. And all that's fine and dandy, but the reality is this, and I would ask you, the listener out there, I've never met anybody who has ever told me they became wealthy by buying annuities. I've never met anybody like that. I've never met anybody who told me they became wealthy by buying life insurance and investing that. I've just never met anybody. And if you have, I'd certainly like to hear about them. In fact, we got a caller on the line. We got an IRS question, but hopefully we can answer this. Ron, are you there? Well, we have Ron here on the second. Hi, Ron, are you there?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you've got a question?
Yes, I do. I owe the IRS $24,000, and I've been making payments. And recently I got a call from some lawyer back east. Well, it wasn't too far back east. It was in Idaho, saying that he could get that debt reduced. At least he could get the late fees and the penalties taken off. That's what he's supposedly guaranteed. You know, he says he could possibly get it down to 10%. But he wanted me to sign a power of attorney, and he said then I'd have to stop paying him, and then we'd go from there. And I just wondered what y'all thought about that.
Well, I'm a little nervous, first of all, about a lawyer contacting you out of the blue. We have some rules, at least here in Oregon, that don't allow us to go out and solicit specific clients that we, you know, I mean, like it's like the old-fashioned ambulance chaser. You can't run out and hand your card to the guy and say, gosh, you know, I'd like to be your lawyer. Other than that, though, I mean, I guess what I would do is call around. There are various lawyers and some CPAs and stuff that will work out, that will do you know, workarounds or workouts and work on compromises with the IRS. And there may very well be some advantage to some people who, you know, who are knowledgeable about it and who are familiar with what the IRS is willing to do. You know, they have certain guidelines as to how much they can discount things and that sort of thing. But whether or not they'll work with you as well as they will with the professional person, I can't say. But I would look around before you sign the agreement. I think I'd check around the local area to see if you got somebody in here in the area that does the same kind of work and is willing to to help you.
You know, one of the things I would do before I engaged anybody like that, and there are people who advertise all over TV and on the radio about helping you with your IRS tax problems, but
before I did any of that, I would pick up the phone and call Kevin Steggy out at Baker Colson CPA firm, because I've had some, I don't want to call them run-ins, but I've had some dealings with the IRS, and I try to pay my fair share of taxes. I don't want to pay them more than I have to, but I certainly want to pay my taxes, and that's the last fight I want to have. So I would recommend having somebody like Kevin, and Kevin is very helpful for me getting a dispute, getting all my penalties and charges removed because the error wasn't mine. And so I would certainly recommend that you talk to a CPA. And if you're, I assume you're in Washington State.
Yes.
Yeah, and probably on the east side, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I know who you are. I know you. So you need to call Kevin and talk to him, and he can help you.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Chuck.
And, yeah, you bet. You bet, Andy. Good call. Thanks. You bet. Bye-bye. Hey, listen, we're listening to Investing Simplified, and I want to just give a quick stock report, and I appreciate that call because, listen, all those calls, and that's a great call because there probably are 1,000 or more people listening to this show who have an IRS problem, who don't want to talk about it, but probably have one. And, you know, all of us, if you're a taxpayer, from time to time, you get them. And I'll tell you a strange thing about the IRS. The other day, I got a letter from the IRS. I got a check, a refund from 2011, because that was one of the years we had Kevin working on our taxes and stuff for us, and we got it all resolved. And then we ended up, I guess, overpaying, but I got a check from the IRS. That wasn't a lot of money, but it was, you know, a couple $100. And then 3 days later, I got the statement from the IRS telling me what the check was for. I thought, wow, I would have thought they would have just put that in with the check, but that's not how they do it. So it's a mystery to me. I want to talk real quick about the market, because I think if you're not, if you don't have some serious money right now set aside, being managed very, very conservatively, I think you're taking a very high risk right now. Markets are hitting all-time highs, but the reality is, even though they're hitting all-time highs, this recovery has not happened. And I'm going to go back to the start of this thing, because a lot of people are under the misconception because they listen to the news every night and they've been totally dumbed down and lied to for the last 12 years, and you believe everything. And if you do, you need to maybe look under the hood a little bit and not just take the information on the top. And for example, the Dow Jones closed Friday at 16,154. Now, it sounds exciting because we're hitting all-time highs again. But the fact is, the Dow Jones closed on 10,907 at 14,164. That was right before the big crash. And we're only up 14.05 in 6 years and 5 months. That's an average return of 2.16. That's not a great return for the Dow Jones. The Dow Jones since 12/31/99, and that's when I say we started in this long-term bear market. And we, Carl and I have been discussing this for 6 years. We've had other authors on about it and talking about long-term bear markets and secular bear markets and what does it mean. Well, what it means is that normally when you go into one of these, they last 16 to 20 years. We're 13 into it, guys. 13. We got more to go. For example, right now, if you go back to 12/31/99, the Dow Jones closed at 11,497. So in 13 years and 1 month, right now, the Dow Jones has averaged 2.91% per year, when the previous 80 years averaged almost 10. That is not a great decade.
You know, Chuck, I keep thinking of how many times you heard the buy and hold strategy for many years, and I think probably there are still some people that still suggest that, and that really reduces your returns in this kind of a market, whereas, you know, in the past, you know, people just sort of rode with it. Well, you know, it took little ups and downs, but now, you're taking a risk if you don't have that strategy that says, you know, there's a time to get out of the market or a time to get into it. So.
Yeah, you know, as Kenny Rogers said in that famous song, you got to know when to hold them and when to fold them and when to walk away.
Yeah.
And really, I have clients, like I was saying at the start of this dialogue here, that I don't know anybody who ever made a fortune buying annuities or buying life insurance. I know a lot of salespeople who sold them who made a lot of money, but I don't know any of the people who put their money into them that made a lot of money, because annuities are designed for income, and life insurance is designed for protection, to pay your family the money that you're not there to pay. And so you're really talking not an investment product. Where investments, when you put your money in investment, you're looking for a return on your money. You're looking for a return on your investment. You don't want to lose your investment, but you want a return on your investment. And I can tell you, without a question, most people that I know that have made a lot of money have done it one of two ways. Well, I've done it three ways. I'll take that back. Three ways. Number one, they have their own business, or they build their own business and they build equity that way. And they build a nice substantial wealth with their business. Number two, they do it with real estate. Or number three, they do it in the investment in the stock market. And I can tell you today, even today, there are some stocks you can buy that I think have a great, great long-term growth potential if you want to buy the money and you buy that stock and put it in there and hold on to it, because it's going to be around a long time. I think of Starbucks. Starbucks has been a bell ringer. I mean, it's been a great stock. And just drive by a Starbucks. Do you ever see them empty? Not very often. There's always somebody in there spending $10, you know. And so there are stocks you can pick and cherry pick, but an overall portfolio to just buy it, stick it there, and not look at it, that is ridiculous. That is ridiculous right now in this market time, and has been ridiculous for this decade. In fact, the one thing this decade has hit everybody with a two by four right between the eyes is that you can't buy and hold. You gotta be very selective in what you're buying. You gotta set targets, and you gotta move that money. And if you don't move your money and you're setting your money, nobody can get wealthy setting their money in the bank at 20 basis points. It doesn't work. Well, listen, Carl, how does somebody get a hold of you?
I can be reached at 503-255-8795 or at warrenallen.com.
And you can reach me at pfgwm.com or 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. And again, you're listening to Investing Simplified. If you want to contact me at info@pfgwm.com and have a question you want us to read on the show or talk about it on the show, don't hesitate to do that. We'll be glad to answer it on the show. Thank you very much for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next week. I do want to say at the start of this season, I did predict that the Seahawks and the Denver Broncos are playing the Super Bowl and the Seahawks would win. And I wished I could predict the same in investments, but I did for football anyway. Thank you very much for listening.